wanted to, you mentioned the Blubber Bay strike as important as the trade union rights campaign.
The Blubber Bay strike involved the quarry workers of the Pacific Lime Company on Texada Island, but a large number of them were Chinese workers. The company management was centered in New York. It was organized and certified, as we call it, certified now, it was organized by the lumber and sawmill workers for some reason, which was then communist-led. And there was a sub-local of the lumber and sawmill workers. The president was Jack Holes, who was a professed communist. They threatened strike, and they got in a lot of trouble. Mr. Justice McIntosh was sent in, and this would give a significant turn to legislative developments, and attempted under the rather inadequate laws of the day to conciliate the strike, and failed to reach a settlement. So they went on strike in 37. At the time, the IWRA was in process of formation. Their first convention was in 37 in Tacoma, Washington. The strike went on, and the company took rather brutal action in evicting first the Chinese workers from their quarters, who remained loyal, very loyal to the union, which was a remarkable development at that time because the Chinese workers had been given second-class status in trade unions practically up to that time. And the families, white families, were evicted. I could mention several of the members of the family today who can recall how their parents suffered when they were forced to move down to Bonanda and live in miserable little shacks, you see, while the strike was underway. Now, the communist, Perchette was head of the IWA at the time, for the lumber and sawmill workers, and it was a lumber and sawmill workers local for a long time afterwards. It became part of the IWA in 38. But it aroused tremendous support in Vancouver. And large mass meetings were held here. And the treatment of the strikers, they were ambushed by a squad of provincial police sent in by the Attorney General Gordon Risner. There was a great deal of brutality. And I remember going in there to investigate as an MP, and I couldn't move anywhere. I couldn't go to the post office, to the telephone office, anywhere, except under police escort. It was a virtual martial law. Now, well, because of this brutality and because of the significant turn in the development of legislation, George Pearson was then Minister of Labor. He was trying to apply the law as he had devised it up to that time to handle this situation. It attracted a lot of attention. Now, they shipped up boys from Vancouver on a picket line which was stationed on the docks of Blubber Bay. And they did nothing more than sing parodies, popular ditties, ridiculing the police. And the police took their vengeance. And one after another of these boys was arrested and convicted for unlawful assembly, which under the code was a rent at that time, where two or three are gathered together and conduct themselves in a manner to cause fear in the minds of the bystanders. They're guilty of unlawful assembly. So in the courts here, they were convicted and sent one after another 6 months in Ocala on the evidence of the wives of the scabs who occupied the cottages overlooking the dock, which had been vacated by the strikers, they'd been forced to vacate them by a brutal action of the company. And that came up in the House of Commons. I brought that up in the House of Commons and demanded an amendment to the criminal code that would and Tom Berger took it up more recently, a criminal code that would make it impossible to convict men on such flimsy evidence. They have obviously biased evidence. Now, one man was brutally killed. He was taken out of his own home, Bob Gardner, taken out of his own home one night. I'd stayed at this place. I knew him well. A very inoffensive sort of chap. Taken out of his home, taken down to the Huskar that the police had set up, the provincial police. And were really goons dressed in provincial police uniform, and he was brutally beaten, kicked, taken to hospital in Powell River the next day, and he died eventually of his injuries. And, of course, Risner was accused by us of murder in the legislature, and taken up, and there's a plaque in our office here. He's one of the early labor martyrs, Bob Gardner. His wife is still living in the Mammoth. She'll tell you the story. And so it was significant because it was the last and most brutal attempt to suppress strike activities by force. And secondly, it was a case that brought to the attention of the legislature the necessity of amending the labor legislation, because we made capital of it in the House. And also it brought to attention the wrongful interpretation of that section of the criminal code intended to deal with a situation like that. This situation and the projectionist strike in New Westminster were the two instances where that section of the code was used, as I contend, quite improperly.
Talking about the section of the criminal code, there is Woodsworth carried on a very strong campaign.
Section 98.
Section 98, which was deleted in 37?
Somewhere.
39, something like that. Now, I've noticed in one of their publications that the communists claim that it was the Canadian Labour Defence League's propaganda that got it repealed.
I can't believe it, because I remember distinctly Woodsworth session after session moving and speaking most eloquently for that, and finally getting the ear of the Honorable Ernest Lapointe, Minister of Justice, who respected Mr. Woodsworth, did an agreement, respected him, and finally got an agreement with Mr. Lapointe that he would introduce an amendment deleting Section 98. Mr. Lapointe was a statesman and realized how dangerous it was to Canadian liberties.
Item of interest that has come up from my study of the minutes has been the Health Insurance Act that was
37.
This seems to have been a very hot issue by the unions. Now, to what extent was this a union or CCF originated pressure? What happened to it eventually?
I think it's more proper to say it was a general public demand to which Premier John Hart acceded, and supported vigorously by the CCF, and he finally agreed to present it to a plebiscite, and public plebiscite approved it.
Well, what happened to it?
Shelved. They appointed a health commission and functioned for a while. Who was in that? I remember the names of the people that served in that for a long time, and just got nowhere.
It was never proclaimed, never put into...
That was supported by the CCF, supported by the trade union, supported by Connie. Everybody saw the necessity for that.
Is it still in the statute books? Or was it never passed?
Must be still on the statute books. It was never rescinded.
So we have a health plan in the province. It's just never been put into...
When Medicare, and the battle for Medicare was on, Stratton brought that up time and again, why we have a law. Endorsed by plebiscite. How could they ever send it when the plebiscite approved it?
Yeah. Now, going back, I think, to the lumber unions, you've done some work in studying the South, and it's all pretty hazy in my mind. Could you run through it, through the IWW, the origins of the IWA, really?
Well, the first organization in British Columbia and on the coast was the Shingle Weavers. They were organized at the turn of the century and affiliated with Leith and Bell. They had the opportunity to organize because they were working in small, concentrated groups for available to transportation. But they wouldn't broaden out. The IWW came on the scene after 1905. And organization in British Columbia is in a very, very unsatisfactory state. But the IWW made greater headway in Washington, Oregon, and influenced British Columbia, because the lumber workers here have always felt a kinship with the lumber workers in the Fur Belt in the Pacific Northwest. I'm trying to summarize this. It's a long story. You have to telescope it a bit. The IWW met, of course, tremendous opposition from the employers. And there was incident after incident of vigilantes being used, as well as sheriff's deputies, to shoot down the IWWs. They did it at Edwards, they did at Centralia, as they did, and they filled the jails. But remember, the IWW in its early days was more interested in street corner propaganda and meetings. And they loved to be arrested en masse, and they filled the jails of Spokane and Seattle and some of our jails up here. Debs was in here, remember, too, with the American Railway Union, and had a big fight with the CPR. But the IWW, they're a migrant, they're organizer of migrants, really, who travel to and from in boxcars and without expenses. No central organization. They kept no proper records. But they penetrated the B.C. woods, and to a very large extent, we recognize it today, they were responsible for through their direct action, quickies, the burning of the blankets, the lousy blankets, the keeping the constant turnover of crews. Crews are coming and going, coming and going. The employers had no stable labor force. They were responsible for cleaning up the camps, the terribly unsanitary conditions in the camps, and the poor food. But the IWW, of course, World War I, in the States, they were blotted out by the 4L, the Loyal Legion of Lumbermen and Loggers, a semi-military organization, and they were persecuted here as being a subversive element, very bitterly persecuted. So they were practically exterminated as an organization. There were lots of IWW men, but the tradition remained. On 32 and 34 and 35, there was a rudimentary organization of loggers here. The story is told of the loggers' organization in Mrs. Steele's book, Compassionate Rebel, where Ernie Wynne succeeded in organizing those 30,000 strong loggers' organizations.
To what extent was the Lumber Workers Industrial Union, which is Wynne's baby, should we say, an outcoming of the old IWW organization?
I would say it was influenced to a great extent, because the IWW brought the idea of organization, of a militant organization. They fired the minds and imaginations of our people. And Wynne had the idea of making it, putting it on a business-like basis, and succeeded, I think, to a very great extent, until it got involved in the OBU schmozzle.
What sort of organization was there in the woods after the collapse of the OBU and eventually the...
Very little, and they formed the Lumber and Sawmill Workers eventually, and affiliated definitely with, and you find the BC delegations appearing at the conventions of the Lumber and Sawmill Workers and associating themselves with the struggle in 36. Now, that brought organization to a head in the United States and up here. For the first time, they had a strike, almost an industry-wide strike, through Washington, Oregon in 1936, a famous strike. It's well written up in Jensen's book, Lumber and Labor. And the carpenters attempted to take the leadership of that. They attempted to make a settlement. And there was resentment of the type of settlement, the type of leadership furnished by the carpenters, who regarded the lumber workers as an organization. They'd had a famous fight at their 1935 convention when the delegation from the West was treated disgracefully, not even given a proper hearing, when they wanted equality of status inside the organization, a chance to organize with reasonable autonomy. And Secretary Treasurer and one of the carpenters of that time really read the riot act to them, and they were sent back. And when they came back, on their way back, they met with Lewis, then forming the CIO. And as a result of the 36 strikes, they formed the Northwest Strike Council to make what they called a proper settlement, and the majority of the lumber workers stayed by this council. Some settlements were made by the carpenters, sweetheart settlements, we call them. The residue of this Northwest Council formed the basis of a developing CIO. Now, Pritchett up here, with his District Council of Lumber Workers here, which was a very small organization at the time, kept hoping that he could reach a satisfactory affiliation with the carpenters, and in Vancouver, meeting after meeting was held with the carpenters' representatives looking to some sort of deal. But eventually it became impossible. He was swept along with the tide of the CIO, and in 36 he formed an organization which was preliminary to the IWA formed in 37. From, what was it, woodworkers. Prior to that, of course, they'd attempted to form a strictly communist organization in the woods, which was up here too, affiliated with the Workers' Unity League.
That was sounds cool. Mm-hmm. Isn't it the Lumber and Agriculture Workers Industrial Union?
No. That's not right.
There was one such union. There was no real organization except the odd local, the IWW and lumber workers during this.
They had a member of the IWW local here.
Yeah.
So, but remember, it was a shifting membership.
Now, the core that went and made up eventually the lumber and sawmill workers, was this an old IWW core, a lumber workers industrial union core, or was it very much a communist core?
No, I couldn't say it was communist. It was just this. Remember, in the NIRA, that was in 33, wasn't it? That sparked all over this continent, sparked the desire for unionization. And the lumber and sawmill workers had been formed down the states as an offshoot of the carpenters, and the desire for organization, and people were flocking to the unions, and they flocked to the lumber and sawmill workers. And, I can't say the communists can't claim credit for that. They took command of it here. But they had to ditch their old organization, the communist organization, the Workers' Unity League, and try and make something out of the lumber and sawmill workers. And they formed a district here of the lumber and sawmill workers and led it into affiliation with the lumber and sawmill workers organization there, because Pritchett at that time, head of it, wanted affiliation with the carpenters, felt that they have greater strength that way. And incidentally, I think he hoped to infiltrate the carpenters. That goes back to an old story. You know the old story of the carpenters and the woodworkers back in, right back at the turn of the century, Green ordered in one stage sanctioned a separate organization of the woodworkers, and there were 40,000 strong. This was objected to by the carpenter's leadership, and they forced him to allow them to raid the woodworkers and absorb the woodworkers eventually as a subsidiary section of the carpenters and joiners.
That was the old timber workers union, wasn't it?
No, the timber workers union was one of the forerunners of the IWA in Washington. Well, this was called the woodworkers union.
Because there was a timber workers union.
It was dealt with by the AFL.
There was a timber workers union that became Winch's organization.
Well, there was a timber workers all through one of the organizations that led up to the IWA, as well as the lumber and sawmill workers. It preceded the lumber and sawmill workers.
Yeah. But then there was no real organized corps or unorganized corps in the woods between, should we say, the First War and the after the collapse of the OBU?
Oh, well, there were elements of organization in World War One.
I mean, after the collapse of the One Big Union in 21.
Oh.
To 1935-36, when the lumber and sawmill workers, there wasn't any real union in the woods then.
They had strikes in 34, they had strikes in 36 here, strikes in 32, the famous strike, somebody told me the other day about the Fraser Mill strike in 1932. And it was said then that the French Canadians were imported as strikebreakers, and somebody from our camp in there now was trying to prove it. And I denied that you could label the French Canadian population of Millardville as descendants of the strikebreakers brought in that period. But that was a famous strike in the Fraser Mills in 32.
The shingle weavers, I believe, strike.
I can't give you firsthand. I prefer you interview Jack Holst about that. He was in it.
What was the general?
The larger strike in which they, mainly the strikes in those days were protests against cuts in wages. But they were pretty good. I have it here. It's an outline, really. Strike action flared up across Vancouver on Thursday with badly organized strikers, meaning we lived precariously in tent colonies, returned to work with slim gains as varied from camp to camp. Later, the union declared the strike had been a mistake because of poor preparations and lack of organization.
Which union is that?
34, that was the. They called themselves all sorts of names, the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union. Have you got this?
No. Mm-hmm. Do you have any extra copies?
Okay. It's a very brief summary. It's just propaganda.
Yeah. Now, what the influence, since British Columbia didn't have very many of the mass production industries, what influence outside of the IWA did the CIO have? Did it have much influence?
The IWA was the main CIO element here after 37.
Yeah, I mean, the fight was led by the IWA rather than by the CIO. Admittedly, it was part of the CIO. But you don't have the mass influence
well,
of
many,
the CIO.
Many other unions run CIO. There was a terrific support for the CIO.
From what I can make out, there wasn't very many unions in B.C.
In the form of CIO Labor Council here, eventually.
Yeah, in 1940. But it was the old CCL.
Yeah.
Well, stayed the CCL. But it was pretty small.
Yeah, so those unions incorporated in that CCL Labor Council were in it from the start.
I just wondering if you had any of the really bitter and strong fighting that you had between elements in labor here that you had in the East.
Not as bitter here as in the States. Some of that bitterness crept up here. Hutchison of the Carpenter said not a stick of CIO wood would be nailed, you see, by his men. And he picketed, you see, our operations and picketed the CIO lumber and boycotted shipments of CIO lumber all up and down the coast here. That was a very bitter struggle in 35, 36, 37.
Do you know anything about the longshoremen strike in
34 was the general strike, wasn't it?
Was it 34 in that period? Because
I only know of because of the contact with that, Harry Bridges of the longshoremen came up and played a very influential part in our international conventions in the IWA. And he played along with Harold Prochet and supported the administration then, which was communist-led. Later, Bridges was sort of repudiated by our fellows when we cleaned house in 41. But the trouble was that Bridges wanted agreements with the lumber workers, you see, that would not interfere with the setup he had on the waterfront. And there was great bitterness because Prichard agreed to withdraw our pickets to accommodate Bridges. And Bridges never carried out any satisfactory boycott or any plan to break the boycott on CIO lumber as produced in up here. Of course, remember that time, too, there was a terrific agitation underway to prevent the export of any lumber from British Columbia to the States. And CIO was a convenient pretext to place a boycott on Canadian lumber.
Well, Bill?
I don't know if I'm telling you anything worthwhile or not.
Want me to ask it? Yeah, go ahead and ask any questions that you have.
I wasn't really prepared, but I am interested in the, obviously, the 48. Now, this is after when you quit in the 40s, but in 48 was the revolution, the October Revolution.
Well, from 37 to 41, the International was under the control of the communists. They maintained control by paper locals, by controlling the organization staff. Now, about 1940, those who rebelled against communist domination appealed to the CIO, and a commission was set up by the CIO, headed by a man named Dalrymple, investigated and found out the truth about the manner in which they've been perverting the democratic intentions of the Union, you see. And by 41, it was cleaned up not so much by an anti-communist move, but by a pro-democratic move. No paper locals, a proper election of delegates to conventions. A clear-cut expression of majority will, you see, instead of the perversions that have been inflicted upon it by the communists. Now, that led to trouble up here in Canada from 41 onwards. Mm-hmm. The Tartarchy Act came down 46? Wasn't it 46?
Yeah.
And the Tartarchy Act demanded certain assurances, yeah. You see, that men were not communists. One trustee elected from the British Columbia delegation refused to sign this affidavit and was dismissed by the International President Fadlin, and the dismissal was upheld by the International Convention, and that angered, and was one of the reasons why the district then here started attacking the International, and the district became the headquarters for propagandists trying to overturn the democratic administration established after 41. That alarmed the international officers. Now, there were 41 up to 48, there was evidence of maladministration. They were able to prove later that favorites of the officers were getting loans which were not repaid, maladministration of funds were being siphoned off for purposes that were not strictly trade union purposes and were sponsored by the Communist Party. Defense funds raised, defense fight against fascism and that sort of thing, and it drained the Union's funds. So for years within the locals of the IWA here, white blocs were formed. We took up the cudgels and fought for clean democratic administration. And they saw the handwriting on the wall. They called a quarterly meeting of the council in October 1948 and openly moved for secession from the International. And appropriated to this newly formed organization, seceding organization, the Workers' Industrial Union of Canada, openly appropriated all the assets, all the equipment, all the funds, all the records, and left the IWA organization to start the build from the ground upwards. Then commenced a real bitter fight. The international officers moved in. That's when I became associated with them. The white blocs and everywhere, the Canadian Labor Congress sheltered the group that reorganized the Vancouver local. They had a strong organization in New Westminster. The Federation and the Congress provided men who toured and told the story to all the local unions. And gradually, the membership repudiated this move and defeated the Workers' Industrial Union.
Now, this white blocs. Is this started by the international officers, or the...
No, it was a spontaneous thing. Fred Cooper here will tell you he was chairman for years of the White Bloc of New Westminster. Just spontaneous protest against the communist domination. George Mitchell was active in that. The same was going on in Dublin, the same going on in Vancouver.
Yeah, but then, and then in 46 it became an open fight, but then...
It was encouraged by the international officers.
Yeah.
Who were worried about the situation in British Columbia.
What about the CCF here? No, the CCF...
I don't think they had any part in that.
Well, there's a lot of guys like Jim Bury.
Because of his association with the Federation of the Labor Council.
Yeah, that's right. But a lot of these people who were CCFers.
Oh, yes. Dan Radford toured all over British Columbia. People like that, Jim Bury.
This is how Tony Gargrave got active, I think. She went around.
It wasn't a CCF move because at that time the CCF was determined to remain aloof from trade union jurisdictional struggles.
Did you know each other?
Yeah.
Now, it seems to me this is interesting because I, the mind, something at the same time there was a, well, the CIO also did a report on them, as a matter of fact, or I think they had a sort of unity policy during the war, and then after the war the fight broke out, but the communists won in Mine Mill. Now, do you have any explanation why, for instance, in the IWA, the communists lost control? Why, and why they kept...
Mainly maladministration, partially the misappropriation of funds, the dictatorial policies, mainly the dictatorial policies, which our men felt was contrary to the will of the majority. Mm.
It was a real rank and file movement.
Okay, Paul. In the later part of the 30s, with the rise of the Spanish Civil War, the communists claimed that a lot of the trekkers, 35 trekkers, continued and went over with the
many of them might.
Mackenzie Papineau
yes.
Battalion. Do you have any recollection here of how solidly labor was behind and organizations like the CCF?
I have no recollection of labor as such being that. There was a general prevailing sentiment in favor of support of the...
What about the CCF? Did they...
Not officially. I think they were in the side of the revolution.
They had no...
There were resolutions passed at that time favoring the anti-fascist resolutions, most certainly.
Did they collect money or anything?
Not officially, but there were a lot of that done. There was a lot of that done.
But they...
A lot of our people went.
They consider it was part of the struggle.
Yeah. As I remember it.
This is the general impression I get, because even the Trades and Labor Council were circularizing their unions for...
At that time, no thought of distinguishing communists and non-communists in that struggle.
Yeah, you know, this seems to be rather interesting that the singling out the communists appears to happen only a few times in the course of history in BC. One time was at the time the Canadian Labour Party broke up in 1928 in the anti-Oriental, or the Oriental question. This is the other question I wanted to ask is...
Remember on that point, there's always been in British Columbia a strong sentiment against red baiting or witch hunting. As far as the trade union movement is concerned, we don't want men pilloried because they're communists. But what we do want is the communists to keep their hands off an independent, autonomous organization. We want no outside influence, not interference, not even in the CCF or NDP. And that is the difference, the policy of the CCF and the Communist Party. The Communist Party kept, as you know, they changed their policy from time to time. First it was trying to dominate, then it was infiltration, so on, changing policy, trying to interfere in various ways in trade union policy and get control of trade union funds for their purposes. The CCF said, we'll support labor's aims as expressed, but labor must remain independent and conduct its affairs on an autonomous basis.
Do you remember much of the anti-Oriental campaigns?
I can remember well when it applied to East Indians, Chinese and Japanese. Famous riots in the harbor here when a shipload of East Indians was kept out in the harbor. The Chinese were denied access to the land, that is timber limits. They were not allowed to work that. They're kept as contract
licenses.
Workers, contract laborers. What?
Fishing licenses.
Yeah. Oh, yes. It was contract labor in the woods, and the unions were not allowed in membership, and then when they did allow the membership, it was second-class membership. They were allowed to form auxiliaries. Joe Mizawa here. His father told him his father belonged to an Oriental Japanese auxiliary, you see. Until I remember where I came in contact with the pulp and sulfite mills, they began to realize that keeping this minority group working at less than the minimum wage, they were getting less than the minimum wage of the day, was endangering the standards of the other workers. So they said, what the hell, it would take them to the union and demand equality for them.
When did this happen? When did this realization?
As I remember, it came into fruition around 34, 35.
What about the election campaign in 33?
35 was a strong... I had the ad here the other day, the ads posted by the liberals. You see, vote for the CCL was a vote for Oriental domination.
This didn't have too much effect by that time, did it?
Well, there was a strong prejudice against them for economic reasons, fearing they were swelling the labor force to the detriment of the white workers.
It seems to me the basis...
In 39, the prejudice against the Japanese was terrible. They wanted them all deported to some island in the mid-Pacific. An MLA down here, Alec Clayton, and I had bitterest rows over that. We had a panel touring the province, pleading for justice for the Japanese Canadians. And we suffered. We suffered. It was such an unpopular cause that the CCF took a rap over that until later years.
So this is one place, it seems, where the CCF came apart from the labor movement, because the labor movement at this time was pretty anti-Oriental.
I don't think that's fair to say that about the labor movement as a whole. A lot of the labor movement were against the Japanese. Well, remember the story of the atrocities, Japanese atrocities flooding the country at the time. All sorts of rumors about what the Japanese were doing here. As a matter of fact, the day after Pearl Harbor, every Japanese saboteur or agent was rounded up at the RCMP. They knew them all. They were all rounded up. These were just little people who didn't know what the score was about, had no beyond a sentimental regard for their native land. They had no idea of engaging in sabotage here. And the real reason they were moved was fear of actions by the white population. The white backlash, as we call it now. Believe me, that was the reason. And I was secretary of the Security Commission that moved them. Lieutenant Governor Woodward called me up one night, took me down to his house and said, I think it'd be a good idea. We're setting up this Security Commission, your CCF MLA, be a good idea if you become Secretary of the Commission. I said, okay, no salary. And became Secretary of the Commission with the consent of my colleagues so that we could speak for more humane treatment. And it wasn't a matter of humanity, it was a matter of common sense to move them in a way that wouldn't harm the rest of the community and to have them move to justice. I remember the editor of the Colonist. Am I getting off the track here?
No,
the editor, when the papers come over and said, you're pampering these people. As you come and see them, and I got a taxi and come on out to the exhibition grounds where we had these people housed, and I took Jack Scott along as a son. Took him out of the building where all the Japanese women and kids were playing around, you know, the little cattle barn, with their bunks fixed up in the stalls. And I said, now, what would you have us do? Push these kids around with bayonets and that sort of thing? And he shut up. This campaign, you see, he'd been working up a frightful campaign, you see, against pampering the Japanese and moving them. But they were moved. It was a cruel thing to do. A lot of them lost their property. And I guess labor was as guilty as anybody else.
I was actually referring to the earlier period.
Well, labor was anti-Oriental, no doubt about it.
As a matter of fact, I heard that Percy Bengott, one time secretary of the Asiatic Exclusion League.
Resolution after resolution at our conventions to bar the Orientals, kick them out of the country.
Which
that was the servicemen, was it?
The Trades and Labor Congress.
Oh, the labor movement. The servicemen.
When did this stop passing?
Federal Institute.
When did this stop passing?
I don't know exactly the year.
What was the reason? Why did people smarten up on this?
Because they began to see that holding a minority group, yeah, working in industry, holding them at substandard levels, are threatening their the general standards.
This is
I remember the case taking place in the Pulp and Sulfite workers up at Ocean Falls, for instance.
This was forced by the Depression, wasn't it, to take this stand, to a certain extent?
I think it came earlier myself.
Came earlier.
Started earlier.
What do you feel like? You feel
I think it was a matter of enlightenment. Do you feel the socialist movement at any
time? You see, you go to a plant like at Ocean Falls, and they were bringing in gangs of contract labor, Chinese or Japanese, working for God knows what. And because they were able to handle them that way, they were displacing men at regular rates. The fellows just wakened up to it. This is damn ridiculous. So they should get the same pay as we are, or if they're as good as we are, and put them on the basis of quality, and we'll all get along better. I remember them thrashing it out in the meetings.
This was about when?
34.
How important were the socialist organizations in opposing this attitude?
Well, they were against discrimination always, as far as I remember.
Mm.
Were they very important in changing the attitudes?
I think education, yes.
Because the OBU thrashed this question out in 1919,
mm-hmm.
and they decided to let Orientals in.
Yeah.
And Kavanaugh got up and made this speech.
They were in.
They're wage slaves, just like us,
yes.
And there's no sense, you know.
They were in then, of course, on the shipyard construction. They were drifting into our industry.
As far as I can gather, no socialist party ever in BC.
And I can't remember.
And the Oriental plan.
No, all I was interested in,
yeah,
how
exactly
influential the day in attempting to change the position of the labor movement. And when I think about it, it was Wally LaFolle that got the Japanese workers into the Trades and Labor Council.
It was, yeah.
And as a representative of the Socialist Party.
Well, the Socialists fought against racial discrimination.
I think it's fairly clear when you see that in the OBU, and then they fought against it too.
I was going to ask you...
How could the Socialists do otherwise?
Yeah, I
know, but...
But you find people like Ernest Bevin.
No.
He was pretty bitterly racial prejudiced,
was he?
I was going to bring up, what were your political affiliations before the CCF was founded?
If I remember, I was way back in 17.
Liberal first.
Very mildly so.
Yeah. Now, did you, sometime during...
Liberal because I was fighting for conscription. I was in the army then.
Yeah.
Just in hospital.
Well, when did you drop to Liberals?
When I got into veterans.
And what
party
would
you
have been in? Would it be the Socialist Party or the Labour, Independent Labour Party or the Canadian Labour Party?
I wasn't politically conscious. I ran crusade, and that was a crusade for the disabled veterans, until I met Woodsworth.
Mm-hmm.
When Woodsworth came in the house, I became acquainted with him and with his wife. His wife started the League for Peace and Freedom. She brought a delegation of German ladies. Is it League for Peace and Freedom?
Yeah, I just wondered where that came from. Thank you.
She brought a delegation, including some German women, to speak to the women, and their meetings were being outlawed. They refused the use of Massey Hall, and some of the ex-servicemen, the wild-eyed ex-servicemen, were raiding their meetings, causing a lot of disturbance, you see. So we went, voluntarily went to Mrs. Woodsworth and said, if you anticipate trouble in your meeting in the large hall in Ottawa, we'll police it for you. We think these women ought to be heard in the name of peace. As veterans, we did this. So I got to know Mrs. Richard. Well, then I began to watch and admire J.S. in the house, and he invited me down to his place, and then he, every Wednesday night, finally, Charlie Bowman, the editor of the Citizen, who formed a Now Canada group, New Canada group, and we met once a week. And the younger man, the younger group, we got to Woodsworth's office, and he devoted his Wednesday evening, which was his only free evening a week, to get to lectures, not only on politics, but on broad cultural subjects. And we got to admire the man and follow him. We were disciples.
When did
that
come for you?
That was way back in 2021.
How old are you now?
Huh?
How old are you now? 74. 21? That'd be your early 30s.
Then I began asking Woodrow. I had a little shack up in Meeks Lake for summertime, and began asking him up there. And he and I used to go out on the lake in the canoe. I was a great canoeist, And we drift around the lake around sunset, you know, and he'd talk and talk and talk and then version of something. I got closer to Woodrow even than Grace did, because of the tremendous things he had in the mind. Then I got in trouble. They slashed thousands of men off the pensions list for technical reasons. The chairman of the board was Colonel Don Thompson, the son of a former conservative prime minister. And I was desperate. I was the legislative representative. I had appeared before the parliamentary committee dealing with veterans affairs. And they just ignored me. I had a massive evidence, and the pension board was just sort of ridiculing me. You know how official it can be.
Mm-hmm.
So I laid charges. Serious charges, with very extravagant language.
Mm-hmm.
And Woodrow backed me up and moved in the House for a royal commission. The Royal Commission was appointed by Mackenzie King, yes. And I was vindicated for my, mildly reprimanded for my language. It was proven correct. These men were reinstated. And then the second part of the commission's inquiry was a review of all the veterans' problems, and I was appointed counsel for that commission to travel to Canada. I was mixed up in those sort of political happenings, but not party politics.
How did you actually get into the CCF then? Through what organization?
I'd known Woodrow. I was living in the North Shore. Ted Garland came through and held an organizing meeting, and I was right there and joined right away.
The CCF clubs?
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're a CCF club man?
Yeah.
You're a chairman?
Yeah. I was friendly to the League for Social Reconstruction. They might organize over there.
Were you in Dorothy T's faction?
Oh my God, I was one of the nominated who got her in the House.
Mm.
I remember insisting on her nomination. The rest was working down on the grounds at Hollyburn there, or fixing up some sort of carnival we're going to have to make money for the kids. I remember dropping my hammer, stripping off my overalls. We just got word the election had been called, and we'd get the campaign going for Steve's. We had no money. And the next Sunday we get out to a sports day at the PME Stadium, and we take up a collection. That is our start. We got elected.
One of the other thing that I've come across reference to the McGinnis trial in 36.
McGinnis trial?
Or 37.
Involving Angus McGinnis?
Well, I don't know. It's just referred to as the McGinnis trial. And I was wondering if you...
Angus was never brought to trial.
I just wondered if it was, because it
had a lot to do with the trials in Toronto at the time.
This was in Vancouver for something to do with one of the unemployed organizations. That's about it, I think, though.
I have been, just one thing I want to, I have been implicated in a lot of racial discrimination issues.
Mm.
When Earl Haig came to Canada, I was instrumental in arranging that and set up a committee to which we nominated a prominent Jewish lady, Mrs. Archie Freeman of Ottawa, head of the Hadassah. And that got me into no end of trouble. The chief of staff tried to have me fired. I refused to be guilty of a discourtesy to Mrs. Freeman on account of race. He tried to keep her off the committee. This was back in 2021 or 2022. And the sequel to that was that the convention in Welkenhaag in the Chateau Laurier, a tremendous convention, you see, their first act was to suspend the regular order of business and move a vote of confidence in me. And the motion was moved by Ron McKenzie, the man later I clashed with on the Bren Gunn issue, you see. And that's very funny. when I moved the motion of reference, maybe they shouldn't go on too. But I made the motion of reference, you know.
You
want
an offer?
I don't know. One of the senior secretaries came and intimated to me that if I proceeded with the motion, that they would rake up all this old stuff. You see, when I was before the Senate committee, you see, accused me of conversion and all that sort of thing. So go ahead. I'm moving my motion. Corwin heard about it, and Corwin got rude. Is it okay? I sat phone down the library and the boy came up with a whole car full of these commission records and all and inquiries. I was completely vindicated and I went ahead. And I rose in the House and claimed the ancient privilege, you see, the very ancient British law that you must not interfere with member of the House of Performers of the year, traveling to and from the House and so on. And King wrote up and said, well, my friend will meet me after the House rises. He says, I'll try and resolve this. And so I went to King's office, expecting, you know, I wasn't going to take up too much time, because you don't spend playing much time with a prime minister. He took 20 minutes time to notice South Africa. He was okay, you know, and then he said, no, I'll just leave this with me, my friend. At last I heard of it. They really tried to threaten me out of it by a smear. They'd smear me, this old stuff. Where, which I'd been vindicated. God, if I'd been found 5 cents out, I'd still be in Kingston Penitentiary. And they were so bitter about me. You see, I fought the establishment.
King was like that, though, wasn't he? That he would try power at first.
But he sensed a decorum.
And if you
say that for the little man.
If you couldn't step on you, then he would deal with you.
Oh, yes.
But he always tried.
He had to do something with me, because I raised the issue in the House. It was on record, as a matter of public record. He had to do something about it.
He tried to power you first, though.
Whatever, you know. Butter me up. As I want my rights, I'm moving my motion.